Okay, at the beginning of the top of Peyamud Aleph, the Mishnah states, Lokeach Perot Shovech Mechaveiro. Person who purchases a production or output of a dove coat from his friend. Now over here, we're going to go with the Pshat of the Rashbam. Later on, we'll add in the Pshat of Tosafot on the explanation of what's going on here. The Rashbam says that there were many, many explanations here of what was going on in the situation the Gemara will see and in this Mishnah, but he says that they're all mistaken or inappropriate and that he'll give us the proper Pshat. His Pshat is one of the easier ones to understand, and again, as long as it's not Halacha L'maisa, I think we'll forego doing the other Rishonim and the Marsha and others that have other explanations here. If it's Halacha L'maisa, then we of course can do those items. But according to the Rashbam, a dove coat works like this. That there are two doves that we call them the mama and the papa, or the matriarch or the patriarch of the dove cote, and they produce babies. They produce birds. They have eggs and they have birds that come after them. The way it works, according to the Rashbam, is that every month they're able to produce another two birds. And the assumption is when they produce those two birds, they produce a male and a female. So if you start at the beginning of the year in Nisan, they will produce a set of babies, of children, in Nisan. Then in Iyar, they'll have another set, and Sivan, and so on and so forth, all the way through, except for Adar. 11 out of the 12 months, they'll give birth to a pair of birds, each one a male and a female. Now, each successive child that they give birth to, or actually a pair of children that they give birth to, will also become productive in the following month. So in the month of Nisan, they're the only ones. At the end of the month of Nisan, they're the only ones who give birth. At the end of Iyar, they will give birth, as well as the children, their first set of children that were born in Nisan. They will also start having children, and then they'll have grandchildren. So there's actually a multiplicative effect, which is that every month, the successive child that are born will produce children, as well as the children from the previous month, as well as their children will start producing. So you have this multiplicative effect in the dove coat. So the Mishnah says, once you buy the dove coat, mafriach brecha rishona. Mafriach here would be to shoo away or to have them fly away, but the meaning or the explanation of what's happening here is that the mocher, the seller here, sold him the production, but what he did not sell him is the dove coat. So the Mishnah has explained to us, how do you keep the dove coat intact in order that the dove coat remains, the shovach remains, and yet you are taking the production? So the answer to that question, the Mishnah says, is to leave the first set of children that are born. The first set of children that are born to the doves that live in the dove coat, if you leave them there, then the parents will not leave. Meaning the matriarch and the patriarch will not leave as long as they have children there. If they're empty nesters, if there's an empty nest and you take all the children, they also leave. They will not stay in the dove coat. So to entice them or to keep them in the dove coat, you have to leave their first set of children there to keep them in the dove coat. So that's the answer here. How do you maintain the shovach? You leave them, mom and the papa, the matriarch, the patriarch, plus their first set of children that are born in Nisan. If they stay, then the dove coat will remain intact and productive in the subsequent years. And you can take all the other doves that are born out of that dove coat because that won't affect the integrity or the ability for the shovach to continue. Now the Gemara says, perot kveret. If you're talking about a honeycomb, now, a person here purchases the output of the honeycomb. Here we're not talking about the output of the honey, we'll get to that later, but the output meaning the bees that are born out of this honeycomb. So the Rashbam explains it is that he says that in the summertime, at the beginning of the summertime, when it comes to the honeycombs, that at a certain period of time, the honeycombs start to produce or are born these bees that come out, swarms of bees. So every 9 to 10 days, a new swarm of bees is born. And he says this happens successively for 3 times. Every 9 to 10 days, there'll be 3 swarms that are produced out of the hive. They fly out of the comb, and then they sit up on a branch, and then you either take that swarm away to somewhere else, or you give them a new comb for them to go into, and they'll start producing in that comb. So he says that in our areas, they actually only produce 3 times, that there'll be 3 swarms that come out of a honeycomb. He says, but I know that in Greece, in our time, that they actually produce 9 or 10, that there's actually, they produce a number of swarms that come out of this beehive. So again, what we're trying to do here is that the buyer bought the production of the beehive. So we want to give him the production of the beehive, but we want to keep the beehive active. We want to have it to be around the next year, because the mocher didn't sell him the hive itself. He sold him the bees that are produced out of the hive. So the way that Rashbam learns it is that the first 3 sets, the first 3 swarms that come out of the beehive belong to the buyer. So he'll take the first 3 swarms that come out, and then after that, the Mishnah says, Notel Gimel Nechilim takes the first 3 swarms, Umisares. At that point in time, he's Misares. Now Misares over here means that we stop the production of more children. Why do you want to stop the production of more children? Because according to the Rashbam, the bees are either producing honey or producing children. It's one of those two. So as long as they're still productive and producing children, then the honey will not be mitrabeh, will not come into the comb. So now the mocher wants his honey because that's what he has the honeycomb for. and the buyer wants the children. So the Mishnah says if you buy the production, you buy the output of the honeycomb, then you're entitled to take the first three swarms. After that point in time, the mocher, the seller, can be misares. He can cause the bees to start producing children or swarms, subsequent swarms, and at that point in time, force them to make honey. Because if you stop them from producing more bees, they'll start to make honey. That's the explanation of the Rashbam. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom here has a different explanation. He says that the three nechilim here are similar to the mafriach brecha rishona in the first part of the Mishnah, which is that the three swarms that are in this hive are remaining for the mocher. The seller wants to maintain his hive. So what he's able to do is actually the seller keeps the first three nechilim, the first three swarms, because that's how he will be able to keep the hive alive and to keep it to be productive. After that point in time, anything that's produced, all the swarms that come out of the beehive will belong to the buyer. And the word misares over here, when he says misares, is that he's allowed to then reduce the productive qualities of the bees. He can't remove it entirely, because then what are the lokeach buy? But he can reduce the productive quality of the bees to the point where they're producing honey, but still producing bees. So even though they won't produce the extreme that they did before, but nevertheless, they still will produce bees, that's what belongs to the buyer. And the seller will keep the first three nephilim, the first three swarms, plus the honey. So that's the way the Rabbeinu Gershom explains this part of the Mishnah. And the next thing, chalotavash. What happens if he sells him the honey in the honeycomb? He sells him the comb itself. So then, meniach beis chalot. He has to leave over two rows of the comb. So now what does it mean he leaves over two rows of the comb? Because if you take all the honey out of the comb, then the bees, the honeycomb won't exist anymore. I mean, that the beehive will not exist anymore. You have to leave some honey for the bees themselves to survive on. So that, meaning, if you sell the whole comb, if you leave two rows of the comb over for the bees themselves to use, then the bees will be able to maintain the comb and it will survive. So when he sells them the chalot tavash, when he sells them the honey, he's selling them all the honey, except for the honey that's necessary to keep the hive alive. And what is that? That's two rows of the comb that will be left behind in order to preserve the bees. Zeitim lakutz, he sells them a zayit tree, he sells them a olive tree to cut the wood. I mean, here he's cutting down the branches from the olive tree. When he's cutting down the branches of the olive tree, he has to leave. He sold them the olive tree, but he didn't sell them the entire olive tree. He wants the olive tree to remain. So how much can you cut off of the olive tree and still have the olive tree be, you know, regenerate or reproduce? So that's what the Mishnah says over here. He has to leave two branches. He has to leave two branches in the trunk. Whatever he cuts down, he has to cut down and leave two branches out of the trunk so that the tree can regenerate itself or reproduce itself. The question of whether or how is a situation that he's allowed to cut down a fruit tree, Tosfot deals with it on the next Amud. It's not really our sugya over here, but Tosfot asks the question. We'll see that the Gemara gets more extensively into this of cutting down fruit trees. But the fact is that Tosfot has come up with situations in where it's permitted or permissible to cut down a fruit tree. In those instances, when he says you get the, you know, zeitim lakutz, you can cut down the branches with the olives on them and take those branches and that wood, you still have to leave in the tree. The tree you have to leave. You have to leave two branches coming out of the tree. So now we have a braisa v'atanya. We have a braisa brecha rishona ushni'a. That you have to leave not only the first set of children, but it sounds like the second set of children. Well, our Mishnah said that in order to preserve the Shovach, in order to preserve the Dovkot, you only have to leave the first set of children. Now we have a Bryce that says the first and second set of children. So how do we reconcile that? So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Kano, Lokasha Hala Haleima. Has to do with the mother and the children. So what does that mean? That means that we have a case here where, fine, the parents, the matriarch, the patriarch, the mama, the papa, who had their first children. So they're going to stay in the dovecote now because they have children remaining with them. On the other hand, the children are born to them in Nisan, those first set of children are born to them. Why are they going to stay around in the dovecote? Their children are also gone. So what we have to say, the Bryce is suggesting over here, and really the Bryce is a more extensive explanation of the Mishnah according to Rav Kahana, is that we have to leave the first children of the children born in Nisan, meaning the grandchildren. The first children have to be left, and the first set of grandchildren have to be left. The first children are left, because that keeps the matriarch and the patriarch, the mom and the papa there. The first set of grandchildren stay, because that keeps their children, their first son and daughter that are born, that are helping the keep the matriarch and patriarch there, they also need to have an incentive to stay. What's their incentive to stay? Is if they, right, have children there as well. How many generations we have to do that for is subject to Machlokes of the Rashbam and Tosafot. So we'll do that in a second. So Gemara says, all right, Maishna Ima, why by the mother do we say Mitztavta Abarta V'Azuga Teshavkinina? Why is it for the mother, meaning the matriarch here, the mama of the whole dovecote, that when you leave her benzug, her husband, and you leave them their children, that she's willing to stay? She has now a partner, plus another set of doves there that are her children. She's willing to stay. Ihi nami, why don't we say the same thing about the children? By the children, the daughter that remains there, it's tistavta ima. She should be suffice or be happy with the fact, vazuga deshev ginla. She should be happy. She has her husband there because they left the two children, the male and the female. So her husband is there, her benzug is there, plus her parents are there. So if her husband's there and her parents there, she has the same incentive to stay in the dovecote. If you say the incentive for the mother, the matriarch, or the mama of the dovecote to stay is the fact that she has children there, another zug, another pair of doves, plus her husband. So the daughter has the same situation. She has her husband, plus she has her parents, another zug of doves there. So why isn't that sufficient? Why is it only worked by the mother that one set of doves is enough, but by the children that's not enough, and we have to force that there are grandchildren in there? So Gemara says, well, that's a principle, it's a general principle. We see it in other places in Halacha. Ima abarta mitztavta. A mother is satisfied or happy with the children. I mean, that the fact that her children are there enough to keep her there. But that's not true the other way. Brata ima lo mitztavta. That a daughter is not, or a child is not, satisfied with the company of the parents. So because of that, we have a similar concept in Halacha by Abba Mechteret. Abba Mechteret, someone is digging under the house, coming to sneak into the house. You have the right to kill this individual who's coming in. So there, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that the pasuk says in Zachar Lava Shemesh, if the sun has risen on him. So Gemara takes that as a, not literally Zachar Shemesh, but someone you know will not kill you. So Gemara says, who is somebody that you know will not kill you when they enter in the house? How do you know that? So the Gemara says, Avala Ben, if a father is coming to steal from the child, we know for certain that he will never kill the child. But the Gemara says it's not true when the Ben is coming to steal from the Av, when the son comes to steal the father. Because they're Achmei Av ala Ben, that the parents always have Rachamim on their children, and therefore they would never do anything to hurt their children. So therefore, when the father comes to steal, we know for certain that he will not kill. Therefore, you're not entitled to kill that robber. On the other hand, when a son comes in to rob from the father, we do not have that assurance that he will not kill the parent. So again, that same concept here, that a parent's view of a child is different than the child's view of a parent. Now we have the machlokas between the Rashbam and the Tosafot. The simple way to understand it over here is like the way Tosafot does, which is that because of this situation, that means that in each subsequent generation, you will have to leave the first set of children. So for the mom and the papa, or the matriarch, the patriarch here, we keep the brecha rishona, we keep their first children here. Those children will keep brecha shnia, which means they're the grandchildren, or the first set of children to the children, to keep them in the dovecote. And then those grandchildren, their first set of children will leave, right, ad infinitum, that'll go on and on and on, that the first set of children to each set of doves that stays in the dovecote, you're going to have to leave there in order to keep them there. I mean that the incentive for them to stay is their partner, plus their children. So ad infinitum, you would have to do the first set of children for each set of doves that you're trying to keep in the dovecote, you have to put their children there, because if they don't have children there, they'll leave. If they leave, their parents will leave. They leave, and so on and so forth, until they reach the matriarch and patriarch, and then everyone will leave the dovecote. And that's what Tosafot says. You can see at the end of the first Tosafot. He says, Vadin, Shnia, Shlishit, Revit, it goes on, ad infinitum, Elodatu, Kiruchlo, Lechashav, Elazel. Right? There's a terminology that's used by the Gemara in other places, that the Mishnah or the Brice or the Tanakh work just gives you an example. But the example goes ad infinitum, meaning that it's just an example, but it goes. It means 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It just doesn't go and keep counting and counting. But the truth is that it is that way. The Rashbam disagrees, and the Rashbam says no. It suffices with two sets of parents. Why is that? Because it's true that the children are not satisfied with their parents being there. That's not enough of an incentive to keep them there. But on the other hand, their grandparents are an incentive. So Rashbam says it's dafka two generations. You have the matriarch, patriarch, the mom and the papa. They have children. Their children will keep them in the dovecote. Then those children will keep their children, meaning the grandchildren will be there. Now, the grandchildren, what's the incentive for them to stay? They won't stay because of their parent, so that's not enough. But they do also have grandparents there. The Rashbam says that's enough. Grandparents, right, plus is considered a zug achrina for them. It's considered another group of birds, not like their parents, separate from their parents, and that'll be enough to keep them there. So Rashbam says, when the Braisa says the first and second generation, it's dafka, the first and second generation, that's all you need. You need the matriarch, the patriarch, their children, and the grandchildren, and that will suffice to keep them there, because then everybody will be happy. They'll each have their partner, plus another set of birds that are not their parents, right? That will be sufficient to keep them there. So that's machlokes between the Rashbam and Tosafot. Again, we went, I said we were going to use the Rashbam and the Tosafot to explain the flow of the Gemara. There are other interpretations. Most of them are much more complicated and much more difficult to explain. They don't flow as easily as the Rashbam does through the Sugya. Now, next. Peirot Keveret. When it comes to, you say, I get the output of the comb. So notel gimel nechilim umisares. He gets the first three swarms, and then he is misares. He castrates them. He stops them from producing in order that they pick up their honey production. But man misarsan. How does he stop the bees from producing? What is a way to stop them from producing? So Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel Bechardal. This is what we had back on the beginning of the Sechta and Daf Yud Chet. Right? That was one of the things that you're not allowed to do. One of the items that you're not allowed to plant next to your friend. If your friend has a honeycomb next to you, you're not allowed to plant a field of mustard next door. Because you plant the field of mustard next door, it makes the bees less productive. They're not as productive anymore. So Amri B'Marova Mishmeid Rabbi Yossi B'Rabbi Chanina. So they say in the West, because of Rabbi Yossi B'Rabbi Chanina, Lo Chardal Misar San. Chadal, mustard is not a way to stop them from producing. Let me talk, shepiem chad. It's not that the mustard makes them or stops them from being productive. I mean, it stops the males. It somehow castrates the males. Let me talk, shepiem chad. But because the sharpness of the mustard that they eat, chozrot v'chlot et duvshan, they go and they consume the honey in the comb. So the way the Rashbam learns this, remember that the Rashbam says that the first three swarms belong to the buyer. And then after that, the mocher can stop the bees from reproducing and then producing honey. So the suggestion, according to Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, is that you put mustard seed there, and that'll stop them from producing. So now the response to the Gemara is, Amri Bar Marova, that's not a good solution. Why is that not a good solution? Because when you put mustard there, that's not misarsan, that doesn't stop them from producing. All it does is it makes them, the taste is so sharp that they go back and eat their honey. So they go back and eat their honey. True, they're not productive, but they're also consuming the honey, so that's not good for the mocher. So that doesn't sound like the best way to stop their production. The Rabbeinu Chananel, on the other hand, that learns it the other way. Rabbeinu Chananel learns that the first three swarms belong to the seller, and after that, all the production or productive capabilities of the bees belong to the lokeach, and the devash and the honey belongs to the seller. So how do you do that? Amir says, then you put chardal there. Why is chardal good? Because that's then, Amri Bar Marav is not a question, but rather part of the solution. Because when you put honey there, it's not misarsan, it doesn't stop them from giving birth, they still will give birth. And that's good for the lokeach. Because the chardal is strong, it'll make them eat a little bit of their devash. They'll consume some of the devash that's there. Okay, so the mocher has to, he'll still get some honey, but he'll lose some of the honey. So they'll still be productive. I am making honey. They will also give birth to bees, but they won't get as much honey and they won't get as many bees. So that'll be the balance, that the mocher and the buyer both get there. The seller will get his honey and the buyer will get his swarms, the additional swarms that come afterwards. So but again, neither of them will get the best, but they'll get, it's a balance between them. They'll still be honey productive, but they also will still be reproductive, and therefore it'll be good for the mocher and the seller. That's the way the Rabbeinu Gershom learns it. And the Rashbam again learns it as that this is misarsan, is not the best way to be misarsan, because it's not necessarily a complete type of sirus here, and that's not what the mocher wants. The mocher wants it to be that he gets heavy honey production. This is actually reducing the honey production. Now, Rabbi Yochanan actually makes another suggestion. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Notel Shlosha Nechilim Bisirus. The word sirus can either be to mean to castrate. Right? That's one way to explain sirus, but sirus can also mean to skip or to move around. Because the word sirus is used, for instance, in the Mishnah Megillah, it's used as, right, a koreta Megillah b'sirusin. Somebody reads the Megillah not in order, but out of order, b'sirusin, skipping. So he says the word sirus here does not mean to, right, castrate, but rather means to alternate, right, means to one and the other. So what does that mean? That means that according to Rabbi Yochanan, it's notel shlosha nechilim b'sirus, that the buyer and seller alternate. The buyer will take the first swarm, the seller takes the second swarm. The buyer takes the third swarm, the seller takes the fourth swarm. So that's the way there will be, up to the third, meaning up to number six. Up to the first six swarms, they alternate. After that point in time, after they've alternated for the first three, then it all belongs to the mocher. The mocher will keep the remaining nechilim swarms after that point in time. But mitnita tano, in the price that we learned, notel gimel nechilim bezech hazeh, you take the sirusim one after the other, meaning that sequentially you take them. After that point, notel achad amniach achat. Then you take a besirus v'dilug. So basically, the Braisa does not agree with Rabbi Yochanan. Now, he agrees with his explanation of what the word sirus means. That as opposed to saying that sirus means to castrate or make them not productive, right? The word sirus means diluk, to skip. That the Braisa agrees. The Braisa supports Rabbi Yochanan in the fact that the word sirus means diluk. But they have a different explanation of how it works. They say that, first of all, the first three swarms are taken by the right, by the buyer. The buyer gets the first three swarms, and after that point in time, right, then they go to an alternating structure where the seller gets one and the buyer gets one, the seller gets one, buyer gets one. So that the first three go to the buyer, and then after that they go to the alternating form, and that's what it means by mocher misares. After that point it gets misares, means that the mocher now comes back into the picture and he alternates with the buyer and getting swarms after the first three swarms. So again, the word misares, they're explaining, the price explained like Rabbi Yochanan, but the actual halacha is different in the sect that they say that you get sequentially the first three belong to the lokech, and only after that do you do skipping, whereas Rabbi Yochanan says the alternating factor starts right away, and not with a delay of the lokech getting the first three. Alright, next one. About chalot tevash, meniach shtei chalot tevash. So this is a sugya that we actually dealt with a little bit earlier on Samechei. Over there, the Gemara dealt with a keveret tevash. And what exactly there, the Gemara was discussing in Samechei about whether it's mechuber the karka or it's not considered mechuber the karka. Is it sold along with the property or not sold along with the property? There, we had a machlokes between the Rashbam and the Tosafot, exactly what it meant. It was mechuber the karka. And what the status of the honey is inside the comb. Right, the honey in the comb, after we're going to see in a second that the Gemara came to the conclusion that it wasn't necessarily mechuber the karka, but it's a special din in honeycombs, because we learned it out from the pasuk, right? So then, once we reach that point in time, the status of the honey inside sounds like the honey is not mekabel tumar, is not ochel. So now the Gemara has a statement from Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana, dvash bekaveret, enu yotze midei machal leolam. The honey that's found in the comb has a din of machal, there's a din of ochel. Now, what we're talking about here is dinei tumah. By dinei tumah, something can be classified as ochel, can be classified as a mashkeh. If it's classified as ochel, then it's mitameh. It gives off tumah bekebeitza, accepts tumah bekoshu, but it gives off bekebeitza. That's the din of the Rashbam. This is actually subject to machlokes Rashi and Tosafot in different places in Shas, whether you also need a kebeitza to accept tumah, or a koshu, it accepts tumah. Here, the Rashbam is like that opinion that bekoshu, there is acceptance of tumah, but to give off tumah, it's kebeitza. And for liquids, they give over tumah bi-revi'it. They accept the bekoshu, and they give it off bi-revi'it. So Rav Kahana's statement is that the din of the devash that is inside the keveret, what's the din of devash inside the keveret? So he says that it is remains as ma'achal. So the Rashbam gives actually two explanations of what that means, that it's ma'achal. You can look, it's about six lines from the bottom here. It says that even the devash that's in the keveret never leaves the status of ma'achal. It's always an ochel. Actually, katseo prefers the ma'achal dvorim. The honey in the comb can be used for two purposes. It can be for human consumption, or it can be for the bees themselves, for the bees to remain in the comb and to survive with the honey that's there. So the Gemara says, or Rav Kahana's statement is basically, according to the Rashbam, that the machal, that the honey is assumed to be for human consumption unless you actively say that it's not for human consumption. Unless you particularly say that it belongs to the bees, otherwise we assume it's good ochel and it can be given kabel tumah and can pass on tumah. That's one explanation of the Rashbam. The Tosafot are the rejects that, and we know that because in other places, the only way that once something is an ochel, that it cannot be an ochel for tumah, is if it's, for instance, if something is ra'oi for people to eat, and then afterwards it becomes disgusting, but people won't eat it anymore, that still has a din of ochel for tumah. It only uses the shame ochel for tumah once an animal would not eat it anymore. So therefore, the Rebbe says, I don't understand this explanation of the Rashbam, because if the bees are willing to eat it, then it's still a machal. If it's a machal, then it will still be mekabel tumah. So he favors the second interpretation of the Rashbam. The second interpretation of the Rashbam is that when it's inside the keveret, when it's inside in the comb, it has a din of ochel. Once it leaves the comb, then it has a din of a mashkeh, of a liquid. So meaning that the Rav Kahana's statement is that as long as the honey is inside the comb, it has a din of ochel. Once it leaves the cone, as a din of a mashkeh, and the din of ochel, mashkeh will be different, as we explained before. For ochel, it's mekabel tumah bekoshu. Again, that's subject to a machlokas, but it will only give over tumah bekebeitza. On the other hand, if it's subject to as a liquid, number one, it doesn't need heksher lekabel tumah, it doesn't have to be prepared, it doesn't have the liquid go over it to make it ra'oi lekabel tumah. And number two is, it'll give over tumah berevi'it, and not require a kebeitza. So that's the explanation of Rav Kahana's statement. Now, Alma Kasavar, from here you see that lo bayi machshava, that you don't have to make the honey in the comb a ochel, you don't have to have an active machshava. You don't have to think about it and say, I'm going to eat this honey. The default status is that this honey is ochel. In order to take it away from ochel, you have to do something. But the standard or the default status of this honey is that it is ochel. So Gemara says, we have a brace that says, Dvash bikveret, enolo ochel, velo mashke. That the honey in a comb is not classified as ochel, it's not classified as a mashke. So now you have a problem, right? We have a brisa that explicitly says that honey inside the comb is not food and it's not the drink, it's not the liquid. So, whereas Rav Kahana is saying that the honey in the comb is default status, is that it's ochel. So how do you reconcile these? We have a reconciliation of Abaye and a reconciliation of Rabba. There's a difference between the honeycomb we spoke about in the Mishnah. The honeycomb has different parts to it. There's the main part of the honeycomb. That standard, the default status of that honey, is that it's for human consumption, it's an ochel. But you also have the two rows. Remember in the Mishnah we said we always leave over two rows for the honeycomb to survive. Those two rows don't have an ochel and don't have a Shame Mashke. Why not? Because what's the default status there? They're being left for the bees to reproduce and to keep them alive, to keep the honeycomb alive. They're not being used for human consumption. So the Abaye divides up the comb. The part of the comb that's for human consumption, that's automatically an ochel, unless you specify that it's not. Those two rows that are designated for the bees, that's what the Brice is speaking about. The Brice is speaking about lo ochel velo mashke, because those are what's designated for the bees, and that's not going to be food, unless you do something otherwise. So that's what Abaye says the solution between, or the reconciliation between the Brice and Rav Kahana is. Rava says, no, that the reconciliation is Amar Rabbi Elazar hi. Rava says that the reconciliation is Rabbi Elazar. Why we have Rabbi Elazar, if you remember, from Daf Samachay, that's not in Kveret Devorim. When it comes to a honeycomb, Rabbi Elazar Mer Harihu Kikarka has a din of karka, because it has a din of karka, you can write a prusbo on it in order to preserve it alone through the Shvi'it. But Eino Mikabela Tuma. It's not mikabel tuma bim koma in its place. Here, this is subject again to machlokes Rambam, the Rashbam, and the Tosafot about what it means bim koma. Right, the Rashbam believes that bim koma means the honey. As long as the honey is inside the comb, it's not mikabel tuma. But as soon as the honey leaves the comb, it is mikabel tuma. The Ri on the other hand says, no, it's not about the kaveret, the comb itself. As long as the comb is in its original position, it's not makabel tuma. But once the comb is moved from its original position, it becomes like a tiltu, it becomes like a metaltel, davar metaltel, and therefore it has a tuma dirabanan. Alright, v'arodeh mimenu b'shav, someone scrapes that honey on Shabbos, is chayev chatat. If it's mechuber the karka, it's like you're cutting something from the ground that's growing, and therefore you're chayev a chatat on Shabbos. The chamimah say, no. The Chachamim say it's not like karka. A kveret doesn't have a din of karka. Veino kekarka umikabela tuma bim koma. It accepts tuma in its place because it's metaltel. It's not mechuber the karka. Sometimes mechuber the karka is not mekabel tuma. Sometimes it's talush is mekabel tuma. If you scrape out on Shabbos, it's an issue of the Rabbonon to do this on Shabbos, but there's no issue in the Torah. You're not going to bring a chatat because you're not detaching something from the mechubar. So now, back there in the Gemara originally assumed, and this is where the original Machlokas Rashbam and the Ri stems from, is that it was Mechuber the Karka, literally. So the Rashbam believed that it was actually fixed. It was cemented into the ground. The Ri disagrees and says, no, that it doesn't have to be affixed to the ground. It just has to be sitting on the ground in its original position to be affixed to the ground. But that the Gemara rejected and said, what's the reasoning? Amar Rabbi Elazar, my time with Rabbi Elazar, what's the reasoning that Rabbi Elazar says that it's Mechuber the Karka? Because we have a Pasuk in Shmuel Aleph. This is in the case by Yonatan. By the battle, that Shaul says that it's a sur for anybody to eat, you know, during the battle or through the battle. And Yonatan was not there when the tzivui happened. And Yonatan goes and he finds, he finds a beehive and he goes and takes honey and eats from the honey despite the command of Shaul. So over there he calls it Yarat Divash. The comb is called like a forest of Divash. What's that? Bechima in Yar Etzel Divash. What does a forest have to do anything with Divash, with honey? Anybody who takes or separates something from a yar, I mean, if you cut a tree or something from the Mechubar and Shabbos, you're chayav chatat. So there's some parallel between a honeycomb and a tree. Just like when you detach from a tree on Shabbos, you're chayav chatat. So too when you detach a honeycomb or take something out of the honeycomb on Shabbos, that is a chayav chatat. So it's a gzeres hakatuv that a honeycomb has a din of mechuber the karka. It's not that it's literally affixed to the ground, but that's a gzeres hakatuv. It's classified as mechuber the karka. That's what Rabbi Eliezer says. So now, according to Rava, what's the solution here? We have a Rav Kahana who says that the honey found in the comb is ochel. Then we have a brisa that says that it's not ochel, it's not mashke. So that's it, no problem. Rav Kahana is like the Chachamim. Rav Kahana is like the Chachamim that it's not a honeycomb is not classified as mechuber the karka. It's not classified as mechuber the karka, then it's going to be ochel. The devash inside, the honey inside is going to be ochel. The honey inside is ochel, right? Then it's going to be mekabel tuman. That's Rav Kahana's statement. On the other hand, the brisa that says the ochel the devash, that's going according to Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer says the honeycomb is mechuber the karka. When you're mechuber the karka, there's no kabbalat tuman. When fruits are still on the tree, they can never be mekabel tuman. So to over here, the devash that's inside the comb can never be mekabel tuman because it's mechuber the karka. So the difference between Rav Kahana and the brisa is the difference in the chachamim and Rabbi Eliezer. Rav Kahana is going like the chachamim that it's talush. A honeycomb is classified as detached, and the Brisa is going to the position of Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer is the author of the Brisa, that a honeycomb is classified as mechuber the karka, and therefore it cannot be mikabel tuma. So Gemara says, Meitve, we have another Brisa. Brisa says, Dvash hazav mikvarto. Honey that flows out of a comb, eino lo ochel velo mashke, is not ochel, not mashke. Now, bishlam ala abaya necha. According to Abaya, we can explain this Brisa. Why? We can say the Brisa is still talking about those two rows in the comb that are designated for the bees. Right, Rav Kahana was speaking about the other part of the comb, which is for human consumption. The part that's for human consumption is ochel in the comb and when it flows out of the comb. Over here, the side that is left for the bees, whether it's inside the comb or outside the comb, it's not classified as ochel because it's designated for the perpetuation of the honeycomb here. So therefore, it's not a din in ochel. So Abaye has no problem. But the Rav, Kasha, according to Rav, it's a big problem. Why? Because once the honey flows out of the comb, it's clearly, right, detached from the comb. It's not, it's talush. Even Rabbi Eliezer agrees once the honey comes out of the comb that it's talush. If the honey that comes out of the comb is already talush, then even Rabbi Eliezer has to agree that it's ochel. So then how do you explain this difference? How can you explain this brisa according to Rava? Meaning that, okay, the first brisa we can explain was authored by Rabbi Eliezer. But here, even if you say Rabbi Eliezer is the author of this brisa, Rabbi Eliezer only believes the honey is considered mechuber karka when it's in the comb. If it's flowing out of the comb already, it should have a din of ochel. So that can't be the explanation of this brisa. So Rava, it's going to be a problem. So what does he say to Rav Zid? So this case here is when the honey flows right out of the comb. Shazav agav klima'us. It flows right out of the comb onto a dirty or disgusting utensil or plate. So there it remains inedible. So when it's in the comb, for Rabbi Eliezer, it's what? It's mechuber the karka, and therefore it's not ochel. When it flows out of the comb, it goes directly from being mechuber the karka onto klima'us, so it never becomes an ochel. It's something that people would not consume. Since it never becomes an ochel, therefore it's not ochel, it's not the mashke. The honey never reached a point of human consumption. Either it was mechuber the karka, where it doesn't matter, or once it flowed out, it flowed right onto a kli maus. Now, Rav Acha bar Yaakov Amar Kegon Shezav Al Gabei Kaskasim. Now here, with kaskasim are really scales, but the Rashi explains not fish scales over here, but rather small pieces of wood. Why? What's the problem? Rav Acha bar Yaakov says that Rav Zvid's not right. Honey has a certain property. It's viscous. It's very, the viscosity of honey is in a manner, or is such a way that you can, even if it falls onto a kli maus, you could scrape off the top of the honey, you could take off the honey and leave the remaining stuff that was on the utensil. I mean, that all the honey is not ruined by the fact that it fell into a kli maus, because you could collect the honey that's there. So he says, no, the only way it could be that it flows right out of the comb into a place where you can't gather is if it falls on many little different sticks or twigs out there, or kindling that's out there, because then you can't capture all the honey. Since each stick has a little drop on it, each one is affected by the stick that it's on, and you can't, even the viscosity of the honey won't help you in this case, to take back and create a full man of honey. So there, that's one answer. But now we have another brisa which creates a problem, which is what? Devash, honey in the comb is not food and not a mashke, not a drink. If you think about it, that you think that it's going to be used for food, then it's metamei tumat tochlim, the mashkim, right? If you think about it for mashkim, metamei tumat tochlim, then it becomes a mashke. So now, bishlam alar bai necha, according to bai, this is no problem. We have two parts of the comb. The human consumption of the comb, that's a food when it's in the comb already. That's ma'achal, that's Rav Kahana. The other two rows of the honeycomb, which are going to be used to perpetuate the honeycomb, those two rows are not ochel, not mashke. That's what the other two braitot said. Now this braitot says, oh, if you think about it, to use it for food, that it will be food, right? That will say this Bryce is talking about those two that are left over for the comb. So right, they're not, by default, they're not ochel mashke, but if you think about to use them for ochel mashke, that's what they'll be. Oh, Rava, what's Rava Kasha? What's Rava going to do? Why was it a problem for Rava? Because Rava explains all these brightos so far as being Rabbi Eliezer, that it's din of mechuber the karka. Well, guess what? When something's mechuber the karka, it doesn't matter what you think about it, you can't make it be mekabel tuma. Fruit on the tree, apples that are attached to the tree, oranges on the tree, grapefruits on the tree, they never can be mekabel tuma, no matter what you think about them. Whether you want them for the juice, want them for their ochel, as long as they're mechuber the karkoi, they can't be mekabel tuma. Same should be true here. You have a honeycomb, right? If the honey is in the comb, it's a din of mechuber the karkoi. If it has a din of mechuber the karkoi, right, then you can never change its status. So how's Rava going to explain this brisa according to Rabbi Elazar? If he can't explain it according to Rabbi Elazar, now it's going to become a problem for Rav Kahana. So Rabbi Kasha, Mecha Rava, Taritachi, explain the brisa this way. So Tosa says it's not an emendation of the brisa. He's not changing what the brisa says, but rather, this is how you should read the brisa. Chishev alav l'achilo, enu metame tumat ochlim, the mashkim, enu metame tumat mashkim. Meaning that the second statements are modifying the first statement of the brisa. The brisa says, dvash rikvarto, enu lo ochel, velo mashke. Right? That's, what does it mean that ochel is not, what's in the comb is not ochel. What's in the comb is not mashke. I'll tell you what it means. That's the second part of the brisa. Even if you think about it for the achila, right, and it would be normally mekabel tumat ochlim, that doesn't work in this case. Chishav lav mashke, if you thought about it for a liquid, even though normally that would make it into liquid, in this case, ain't a mashke, it's not a liquid. So that's the way to explain the brisa according to Rava. Rava is basically saying that the second part of the brisa is an explanation. It's not coming to say that's the exception, that it's not ochel, not mashke, and the exception is when you have machshava, but rather it's an explanation of what it means that it's not ochel, not mashke. What's the explanation it's not ochel, mashke? It means that even if you think about it for an ochel, or even if you think about it for mashke, it's not an ochel, not a mashke. Why? Because this is Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer, the author of this brisa, and Rabbi Eliezer is the author of the brisa. It says anything that's mechuber the karka is not mekabel tuma. So to hear this dvash, mar the kaveret, that's mechuber the karka, or classified as mechuber the karka, going to Rabbi Eliezer, will not be mekabel tuma. Tiny Kavasei de Rav Kahana, we have a brisa that supports the position of Rav Kahana. It's not clear here what the Gemara is doing at this point in saying that there's a brisa like Rav Kahana. It says, Devash b'kvarato, metami t'mot ochlim, shalob b'machshava. It's an explicit brisa that says that the honey in the comb is classified, right, as ochel, even without any machshava. So you can read this one of three ways. You can either read it that now they're giving support to Rav Kahana's position that the other brayto don't matter. I mean that the other brayto are irrelevant because we have a brayso and that supports the position of Rav Kahana. If you say that, then it means that any part of the honeycomb, no matter what, whether it's the human consumption part or the two rows, according to Rav Kahana, are automatically ochel unless you have a machshav otherwise. That could be one way to explain the Gemara here. Or you can explain the Gemara in the context of a Abaye Rava. This brayso, right, is saying that Rav Kahana is right, this brayso, but it's also with the qualifications of a Abaye or Rava. So if it's qualified according to Abaye, that means that when the brisa here says that mitamei tumot ochlim v'loch machshava, that's talking about the part of the comb that's for human consumption, not to the two rows that are left over to perpetuate the honeycomb. Or according to Rava, right, this brisa is according to the Rabbanon. Right, so this brisa is according to Rabbanon. The other brisos were going in according to Rabbi Eliezer. So there is a different author as to the brisos, which is similar to almost the first way we explained it, which means now that the dvash in its entirety would be classified as ochel in this, and we have a brisa to support the position of Kana in that situation. Okay, now the Gemara moves on to the next part of the Mishnah. Zeitim lakutz meniach shtei grufiot. If he buys the tree, the olive tree to take for its wood, right, he's allowed to cut it down, but he has to leave two branches so the tree can regenerate itself. Over here is where Tosafot discusses how exactly he's allowed to do this. Why is he allowed to cut down a live tree? So we won't get into it again. It's not the sugi over here, but you can look in the Tosafot if you want to see how he comes up with the hechitimtzus possibilities for cutting down the tree where you're not ruining the fruit production or you're permitted to do it even though it's a fruit tree. So Tan Rabbanan, alokeach ilan mechaveiro lakutz. Person who buys a tree from his friend to cut it down. Magbia. Now when he buys it to cut it down, he's cutting down the current tree, but he's not there. He shouldn't destroy the tree that exists. Meaning that the person who sold it to him expects the tree to regenerate, and he'll keep that tree that's regenerated. All he's offering him right now is the wood that's on the tree currently. So what should he do? That depends on what type of tree. If it's a normal tree, magbiyam in a karka tefach, you come off the ground a tefach. If he leaves in the stump, a stump that's a tefach high, then the tree will regenerate itself. Because so he leaves a tefach, and then he cuts it down. Betulat ha-shikma. Now according to the Rashbam, we read the Rashbam first, and then Rabbeinu Gershom. Betulat ha-shikma means a sycamore that's been cut for its wood for the first time. If that's the case, gimel tefachim, you have to leave the stump that's three tefachim high in order for it to regenerate. Right? If you don't leave three tefachim, it won't regenerate properly. It won't grow back as strong as it did before. Therefore, you have to leave three tefachim. Stan ha-shikma, according to the Rashbam, means a sycamore that's already been cut once. It's already on its second cutting for wood. In that case, you only have to leave two tefachim for it to regenerate. Right? You only have to leave a stump that's two tefachim high in order to generate. So it's the first time you need three tefachim, the second time you need two tefachim. The Rabbeinu Gershom explains that B'tulat HaShikmah versus Stan HaShikmah means, B'tulat HaShikmah means just the branches, not the trunk. If you say take all the branches, not the trunk, you have to leave a trunk that's 3 tefachim high. If he says Stan HaShikmah includes in it not only the branches, but the trunk itself, then you have to cut it down. You can leave up to, you only have to leave 2 tefachim of a stump. That's the way the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it. B'kanimu G'vanim, if we're talking about reeds or vines, grape vines, then you can cut them back. If you give the wood for that, mina p'kakul l'mala, from the knot in the wood, and upwards, you have to leave that not point, you have to leave, because that'll allow it to regenerate itself. When it comes to palm trees and to cedars, there you can uproot them entirely, because in gizan machlif, they don't regenerate. Since they don't generate, if you bought the tree, it means you bought the tree for everything, because when you cut it down, they're never going to go back again, so you can may as well take the whole thing. The Gemara says, is it really true that when it comes to B'tulat Shikma, you have to leave 3 tefachim in order for it to generate, regenerate? We have a problem. What's that? We have a Mishnah by Shvi'it, which is Rimini. You're not allowed to cut back a sycamore on Shvi'it, because it's work. Why is it avodah? Because one of the things that you're not allowed to do on Shvi'it is prune trees. You cannot prune trees that help the tree grow better afterwards. That's an avodah. That's avodah takarka on Shvi'it. It says, you're not allowed to prune on Shvi'it because it makes the tree grow back better. Now, the truth is on Shvi'it, there's a differentiation the Gemara makes in Moed Katan between avruye and ekume. That there's a difference between if you do something to improve the growth of the tree or the ekume to sustain the tree. You're allowed to do work on the tree that sustains the tree or keeps it at its current status, but you can't do work on the tree that makes it better. So what the Brisa here or the Mishnah suggests in Shvi'it is that you're not allowed to cut back a B'tulat Shikma, because when you cut it back, it'll grow back even better and bigger. So that's pruning on Shvi'it. That's considered avodat hakarka. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, kidarko asur. That if you do it normally, that is asur. Right. So that you have two possibilities. Either you have to leave more than 10 tefachim of the stump there, or you have to cut it down all the way down to its roots. Either way, the tree now will not grow back to its full height. But the implications for this are anywhere between 0 and 10, the tree would grow back. If that's the case, why do you have to leave 3 tefachim by B'tulat HaShikma? If on Shvi'it it's a problem to cut a tree anywhere between 0 and 10 because it'll grow back better, then that should be enough for the buyer here to leave anything between 0 and 10. Why does he have to leave specifically 3 tefachim? So that's why it says, Mim Aretz Hu Dekashi, that only when you cut it down to its roots is it bad for it. Ha'idach Malila. Anything above that, up to 10 tefachim, sounds like it'll be fine for it. So the simple answer is that what? Gimel tvachim alilo. Right, so that when it's 3 tvachim, that's the best way. When you cut it at 3 tvachim, then it'll grow back to its best status or its best height. But miima aretz, right? Vadai kashila, right? When you cut it down all the way down to its roots, then it's definitely bad for it. Mikam v'alech, lo mikashi kashila v'lav mi'uli ma'alila. According to the Rashbam explains here that between, again, it'll be between 0 and 3, and then between 3 and 10, it'll be neutral for it. So it says it can't just be neutral, because if it's neutral, that's not a problem on Shvi'it. To cut a tree back and it goes back the same way, that's not the problem on Shvi'it. The problem is that it gets better. So it doesn't say it means that we don't know if it's good, we don't know if it's going to be bad. I mean, it's a throwing, it's a flipping a coin whether it'll be good between 0 and 3 and between 3 and 10. So therefore, Gabe Shvi'it, by Shvi'it, Avdin Amidei Devadei Kashila. On Shvi'it, we want to ensure that the tree does not go back in a beneficial way. So what do you do that? That means either you leave it above 10 tefachim or down to 0. There we know for sure the tree will not go back as better than before, and therefore you avoid being violating an Isur de Oraisa. Question here, the Rambam, Rashbam says here that Shvi'is is Isur d'oraisa. Question is whether you can read into this Rashbam that Shvi'is b'zman hazeh is d'oraisa according to the Rashbam. But the Rashbam just commenting in Shvi'is when it is d'oraisa, this would be a problem, right? Gabi mekach umemkar avdina midi devadi malilo. When it comes to buying and selling, when it comes to transaction, then we buy only something vidi madi malilo. Then we have to leave for the mocher. The mocher has the upper hand here, and the lokech is buying, so he has to leave him something that for sure will make the tree better. What's for sure will make the tree better? That's 3 tefachim, and that'll be the difference between them. Now the Gemara says, "B'tukalim ra'azim chufer mesheresh." When it comes to palm trees and cedars, you can take out the whole thing. V'hishen gizan machlif, because they do not regenerate. Gemara says, "V'erezen gizom machlif." Is it true that a cedar does not regenerate? V'adareish rabichir ba'lulinai lo laini. He says, "Dareish the pasuk ma'idichtid tzadik katamar yifrach ke'erez b'avanon yiske." Right. So when it comes to tzadik, tzadik is compared both to a tamar, to a deko, and to an erez. So it says, "Imer tamar, imnemar tamar, lamanemar erez, imnemar erez, lamanemar tamar." What is the tzaddik after we compare both to a palm tree and to a erez, to a cedar? What's the difference between a cedar and a palm tree? So he says, "Ilu nemar erez." Had he said erez, lo nemar tamar, and had not said a tamar, iti omer my erez eno se perot, av tzaddik eno se perot. I would think that a chas shalom, a tzaddik doesn't have perot. Perot over here is like we say every morning, el darim shadam. So that he would get no perot. I mean that either his perot, there'll be nothing left for him in Olam Haba, or that if he gets benefit in this world, he won't have anything back. So perot can refer to the benefit, the schar of the mitzvah, b'olam hazeh, or schar b'olam haba. Either way, that we would think there would be no perot for the tzaddik. L'kach ne'emar tamar. That's what the palm tree is. The palm tree is a fruit-producing tree. Right? So therefore, the fruit-producing tree is the tzaddik has perot, that he has both perot v'olam hazeh, and he has perot v'olam haba. He has a keren in one place and perot in the other place. So now, v'im nemar tamar, what happens if it just wrote the palm tree? Lo nemar eres, and didn't write a cedar tree. Ayti omer, ma tamar in gizo machlif, just like a palm tree does not regenerate, at tzaddik in it goes to machlif. So too, a tzaddik does not regenerate. What does it mean a tzaddik doesn't regenerate? That chas v'shalom, he won't have a child, that yimalei makomo. So that always means regenerate. Regenerate means you have a child that will fill his place or do the same as him and follow in his footsteps. Kach nemar erez. Therefore it says, erez a cedar. So therefore, what are the properties? The properties of a tamar is that it's fruit-bearing. Property of a cedar is that it's gizom achlif, that it regenerates. So you see that a cedar does regenerate over here. So elahaches, kinan, Sumar says, what are you going to say about this? Bashar mine arazim. We're talking about other types of cedars. Kedama, Rabbi Ravuna, we bumped into this other places in Shas. Dama Rabbi Ravuna, Amrei Bei Rav, Yud mine arazim. There are 10 different types of erez. There are 10 different types of cedars. Dichtiv, Shneamar, the Pasuk says, Etain ba midbar, I will make grow up in the midbar, in this desert, erez. So truly, if you read the Pasuk, erez here is just listed as a single tree. And actually, the way the Pachamim Darshan even looks that way. But the way to read it now is erez, colon. Now erez is both as a meaning in a particular sense and the broader sense. Now erez both means a specific tree, a cedar tree, which we'll see a second in the Gemara. Also, erez is a generic term for all these types of trees that we're going to mention here, 10 types of trees that all are classified as erez. Equivalent of something like Xerox, right? When you say Xerox, Xerox is a company, but Xerox also means to make a copy. So the term is used both for a particular company, but it's also used as a generic term for copying. So over here, erez is a particular term for a specific tree, a cedar, but it's also a generic term for these number of items. What is that? So the pasuk says, erez, shita, hadas, etshemen, ashim. So now the Gemara goes through these items. Erez, arza. The erez is mentioned in the pasuk is, in arza is a cedar. Shita is tornita. Tornita, look in the Rashbam, is a pine tree. Hadas we know is asa's myrtle. Eight shemen is afarsima. Eight shemen that's mentioned in the pasuk is afarsima, which is balsam. Brosh that's mentioned in the pasuk is barte or brate, which is a box tree. Tidhar that's mentioned in the pasuk is shagaz teak. So asim, and then vete ashur is a shurvina. There, these 7 items are mentioned in the pasuk. Right, I'll put all of these or place all of these in the asimatam. That I'll place them in the bivai. They'll grow up in the desert. So there's the 7 items. Now the ashur, the Rashman says he doesn't know what it is. We don't know what that tree is. That shurvina is. So Mar says hanizayin. That's only 7. You just said there were 10 types of cedars. So kiat ravdimi amar usifolem. They added on 3 additional trees that are classified as cedars. Those are alonim, almonim, and almogim. Alonim are botne, which are pistachio nuts. Almonim are blote, are oak trees. And almogim are kasita. If you look in the Rashbam, what's kasita? He says it's ilan shegadol bayam. It's a tree that grows in the sea. V'yakar bay, it's very expensive. V'korin coral. It's called coral. So that's what it is. Almogim are coral. That's a type of cedar here. Ikadamre, that the 3 additional items were arugim, armonim, and almogim. Arunim are ari, which is laurel. Armonim are dulve, right, which are chestnuts. It's mean dolev. Dolev is a chestnut. Almogim are kasita, as we said before, are coral. So again, here these are 10 different types of cedars, and that will be the explanation. So when we say gizomachlif, when we say that it regenerates itself, that's not about the eras, the core eras, the cedar itself, that does regenerate. So that means, again, according to that, they'll have a child, that the explanation, the mashal by the tzaddik, is that he'll have a child that fills his place. According to the Rashbam, what his eras means that when he falls down, he won't get back up again. So that Shevi Pol Tzaddik Fakam, that he will get back up again. That's what it means, gizomachlif. When we say in gizomachlif, that was mentioned right before, that's why you're allowed to cut them down all the way in the brisa that we brought before. That's referring to all the other arazim, the other 9 types of arazim. That ain't gizlo machlif, and there, that's what those were referring to. Okay, we'll stop over here.